the blessings of love and respect we offer to all, in times past and present, who have opened the doors of wisdom, reuniting all beings with their intrinsic purity. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. The recitation of this rosary ever expands the awakening of faith in the three jewels, Bodhi, Dharma, and Sangha. Bodhi Saranam Gacchami, Dutiyampi Tatiyampi Sabaha. I turn to the perfect nature of truth for guidance. Again and yet again may it be so. Dharmam Saranam Gacchami, Dutiyampi Tatiyampi Sabaha. I turn to the teachings for guidance. Again and yet again may it be so. Sangham Saranam Gacchami, Dutiyampi Tatiyampi Sabaha. I turn to the holy order for guidance. Again and yet again may it be so. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Dukkha, the noble truth of suffering. Dukkha Samudaya, the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Dukkha Nirodha, the noble truth of the extinction of suffering. Dukkha Nirodha Gami Patipada, the noble truth of the path that leads to the extinction of suffering. So long as these four noble truths are not understood, we shall wander in sorrow and ignorance. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. All formations are transient, anicca. All formations are subject to suffering, dukkha. All things are without a self, anatta. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Namo Prajna Paramita Hridaya, homage to the wisdom in the heart. Form is not different from emptiness, and emptiness is not different from form. This is the teaching of our spiritual ancestors, Gautama Buddha, and all the great teachers who have transmitted the Dharma to this holy day. Blessed is the knowledge of emptiness. Homage to the devotees of this and all paths of self-purification. May all find simplicity, the joyous and practical guide. The Dharma, being the contents of enlightenment, in which there is no bondage and no suffering, offers freedom from the cankers of ignorance and fear. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Sangha is the holy order of spiritual ancestors, monks, priests, and all those who follow and practice this path. Homage to the Sangha. Homage to all who are approaching this holy path. Homage to all who follow and establish this holy path. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. By compassionate comprehension that dissipates delusion, by compassionate aspiration that harms no one, by compassionate speech that makes for clarity, by compassionate self-discipline that brings no regret, by compassionate livelihood that brings no discredit, by compassionate endeavor that results in goodness, by compassionate mindfulness that proves this path, by compassionate awareness that leads to nirvana. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. With this recitation, I do confirm my acceptance of these three pure precepts. The precept of restraint and religious observances. The precept of obedience to all good laws. The precept to benefit all sentient beings. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. With this recitation, I do confirm my acceptance of these 10 grave prohibitive precepts. Not to lead a harmful life, nor to encourage others to do so. Not to take that which is not given. Not to commit or participate in unchaste conduct. Not to tell lies nor practice believing the fantasies of authority. Not to use intoxicating drinks or narcotics, nor assist others to do so. Not to publish other people's faults. Not to extol oneself and slander others. Not to be avaricious in the bestowal of the teachings. Not to be angry. Not to speak ill of this religion or any other. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. In the practice of loving kindness. In the practice of pure attention. In the practice of ever-expanding faith. In the practice of constant devotion. In the practice of inquiry through correct dhyana. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Oh, happy blessed day. Oh, happy blessed place. Oh, happy blessed time. Oh, happy blessed path. Oh, happy blessed opportunity. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Here in humble submission, in order to experience this most perfect now, I deeply vow and sacrifice all thoughts, all tensions, all pressures, and desires. I am born of karma. I am heir to karma. I abide in karma, and I am supported by karma. Whatever I do creates karma, and I shall surely experience this karma. The merit for all good acts I do freely offer to all beings. Dutiampi tatiampi salha. Again and yet again may it be so. Willingness is the name of the key to the gate of awakening. For even to awaken from deep sleep and face the new day, there must be the willingness to do it. Here in my hand is the opportunity, and the way is clear beyond the gate of thought and desire. There is no self and other, as the awareness of pure, undisturbed consciousness slips into all consciousness. We are here to end suffering. If ending suffering is more important than anything, we will end suffering. If ending suffering is not more important than anything, we will not end suffering. If I am suffering, it is because I am choosing something over ending suffering. We are not here to create and cling to beliefs. We are here to pay attention. We are here to use everything in our experience to see how we cause ourselves to suffer, so we can drop that and end suffering.
Not going to say anything, because this is the way to raise a person to know the real meaning of life. Mm-hmm. You know, ego, karma was just desperate to get me to believe that and go unconscious so that I would then condition another human being so that then it would feel some sort of artificial relief.
Mm-hmm. So karma was desperate to get you to believe this so that you would then condition another human being so that karma would get some sort of relief.
Well, yeah, or just that I would act out of it, I guess, so that I would get some sort of relief. But what I saw was the impact on the suffering world. You know, what I saw was that when I act out of egocentric karmic conditioning, I stayed with it. Mm-hmm. And then what I noticed was that it was so difficult to practice with. Mm-hmm. Because it was hitting something deep inside of me that I learned at age 12. And I know it was age 12, I know what happened, I know where I was, I know we moved from Oklahoma to Texas. And my life changed. Mm-hmm. It was no longer okay to be me. There was something that I had to figure out and figure it out quickly to fit in. But I couldn't quite figure it out. Mm-hmm. And there was that's when that system really kicked in for me, you know, mm-hmm. karma. Just like, all right, you know, that hypervigilance, there is something wrong with me. And if I can figure out how to be perfect or successful or liked or have a best friend or whatever it was, a piece of content, then I'll be okay. Mm-hmm.
So you can really see where that system kicked in for you at age 12. And that's that belief that there's something wrong, that you're not okay as you are. And it sounds like that was really triggered with this that happened.
It was. Mm-hmm. It was. And to not be looking, you know, to be turning the attention inside rather than to be believing it. I mean, ego just had a field day. It was just like, so, you know, every sensation in the body that it could think of that would make me leave the moment, or, I mean, I didn't send an email, but write an email to the coach, you know, oh my gosh, and then it would use, it tried everything, then it would kind of try calm language, here's one, but it was always to change something outside because its meaning about it was, it wanted me to get caught in that. Really, if you just can get this external thing, get her on the field more, then you won't have to feel this way. Completely leave thinking that I'm going to believe that and do that, and not pay attention to the fact that this thing, the devil, is torturing me.
That sounds like you weren't paying close attention to that.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. It felt like hell. I'm just going to. You know, the only relief, there were two moments of relief. And one was, I went and just kind of got, I was like eight. I'm like, I'm going to bed. You know, everybody else is going to bed. And Claire came in, and she was laying on my bed, just kind of chatting. And I'm thinking, you don't feel bad. Why did you feel bad? I shouldn't feel bad. You shouldn't feel bad. You know, but she's just chatting, you know, just about life. You know, yeah, I've got this paper to do. But then we kind of started talking about the, but as she was chatting and she knew she was okay, I disidentified it too. It's okay. This kid is like the best kid. She's my kid, but she is like just the greatest. So there I was, disidentified. Wow, relax. She's okay. Because, you know, I mean, I can just feel the emotion. I mean, ultimately, that's what my heart wants, is for her to grow up knowing she's okay. And ego tells me that she's going to know that if she gets to play more soccer, which is the lie. She's going to know that if her mom disidentifies and just chats with her at night and doesn't say, don't you feel bad about not playing soccer? And it had it all backwards. And it's just, so that was my one disidentifying. And then I kind of woke up a little bit into it. And then we had this cat come home who had been gone for 5 days. So then there was like, oh my gosh, the cat's home. So, you know, for a minute there was this disidentifying. But besides that, it's just, you know, doing everything it can, anytime I don't pay attention, to feed me a story that's really horrible, you know, that produces this, that makes me, takes me to that place of there's something wrong, there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong with her, there's something wrong.
So anytime you're not paying attention, it's feeding you a story to get you to believe that there's something wrong. And then when you're just able to just be with your daughter who is okay and is chatting about life, and when you're able to see that, then you can disidentify and see that she's okay, and she doesn't need to play more soccer in order to be okay. And it's trying to feed a story that the external has to change.
It's something. So disorienting to it, because it's like, that cannot be, you know, that's not right. You know, do not believe your experience. Listen to me. It tells me, it's embarrassing to stand on the sidelines and watch your daughter's team play without her. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, and really, if I looked at my experience, it was a great game. It was pretty fun. Until my head would go to, why didn't we play? I mean, I love the coach. She's got this great opportunity to learn. All these kids have played with this guy for like 2 years. She is really, really good. But it takes all that away, and it says, there is something wrong with her and with you. Ultimately with me, you know, it's a projective thing.
So the story it's feeding is that ultimately there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's how I feel in the body. You know, just this shame. You know, I can only describe it as shame. So I would just love to hear people's experience of working with it, because it's something I dabble in. I don't like to look at it very closely, the shame thing or the, yeah.
It sounds like you laid it out very clearly, so that you were able to really see the process and watch the process.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I just want it to go away. I just want it to go away. And I sense that might be what's holding me.
Well, that just did seem such a beautiful example of how conditioning through the generations, in fact, does what it does. Mm-hmm. And what I was looking at this morning was how it's like a spider web, with conditioning being the little black widow there that's created this web. And if I put so much as a toe in that web, it's got me. I can't. And the more I try to get out, the more I'm stuck. And that process of not getting close enough to get hooked feels for me like what I need to. It's the moment by moment by moment by moment practice.
Mm-hmm. So the moment by moment by moment practice is to not get close enough to it that you get hooked and not stick a toe in that spider web. You'll just get entrapped in.
Yeah, and to be able to do that, it seems I need to keep in my awareness that the web is there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In order to do that, you need to keep in your awareness that web is there.
Yeah, which feels like what I project on what just was being described, because, okay, there it is, this is the way it's trying to get me now, and for me, I watch as a little story starts, you know, muttering along, and that's, if I turn my attention to that and get close enough to it, then I'm stuck again, and Lord knows when I'll be able to free myself from the web, because it feels like, it's a really good analogy for me right now, because I can see how once I'm in the web, it just sort of coats me with webbing, and then it's impossible to remember that there's a life outside the web.
Mm-hmm. So then once you get in that web, it coats you with that webbing, and it's impossible to remember the life outside the web. And so to keep in your awareness how it does what it does with those stories, so then when then you can realize that turning your attention to those mutterings is going to get you trapped in that story.
Yeah, having any relationship with it, having any conversation about, even about, almost about, I don't want to go there. not getting close enough so that the conversation can do more than mutter.
So not getting close enough so that the conversation can do any more than mutter.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was having a wonderful experience from that this morning, and just, it's like I'm having this avalanche of insights. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking recently a lot about energy and watching how the energy is really pumped up.
Mm-hmm.
And what conditioning wants to do is say, watch out, you're getting manic. And so you got to put a lid on it.
Mm-hmm. So you've been watching the energy and then watching conditioning come in and say that you've got to put a lid on it because you're getting manic.
And that would be the toe in the web if I believed that and tried to do something to make my energy change.
Thank you.
Wow, lots of things. I'm not sure where to start, but I'll start with energy, I guess. Mm-hmm. And also just being with the, practicing being with the sensations and not the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I was practicing in the night last night with some very strong sensations and just practicing for a change, going into the sensations and not the story about the sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really intense, but when I really sat with it, I couldn't tell whether they were really good or really bad. You know, I couldn't tell, is it that I can't stand this, or that this is so good I don't want it to stop?
As you practice with staying just with the sensations rather than with the story, as you were going into those sensations and experiencing them, you realized you couldn't tell if they were so bad that you couldn't stand it, or so good that you actually didn't want them to stop.
Yes, exactly. And and they eventually passed, and it was over. But it was just such an amazing experience to just be me and them and nothing else going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then this morning, when I was awake and conscious and doing something else, I started getting into the story about them. in retrospect, you know, and I just. You know, it was such a familiar story, and it was so, you know, what I heard myself saying was, I just so want to get over me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I meant really was, I just am so sick of it all being about me, you know, and I just thought, I wonder how often when I'm in a suffering place, there's a story that somehow is all about me.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how often suffering place there's a story that's all about you.
Yeah, and I just thought that would be a really interesting trigger to look to, you know, say, oh, I'm suffering, what's the story about me right now?
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't really had a chance to practice that yet, but it feels like it might be worth trying.
Mm-hmm. Because it might be worth trying to pay attention to, and whenever you find yourself in a suffering place, looking to see if you can see that there's a story about you.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about that being a 12-year-old and moving, because
mm-hmm.
something happened to me when I was 12. We moved from one, not state to another, but one city to another. It might as well have been another state. You know, they all dressed differently, and they, you know, and I didn't know who I was there, because that's not the way my world looked.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had the sense that, in a way, that's what's going on right now, is like there's been some kind of shift in this being in some way, some way related to practice, and my world looks different than it used to. And somebody doesn't know who she is in that world. And so it occurs to me that those places of newness, those, wow, this doesn't look like the world I know, are such a huge opportunity for conditioning to say, well, then you're wrong. It's all wrong. It's all about, you know, it's all about you. You did it wrong. You're the wrong person. You don't know how to do this. You're a failure. You don't fit. It just sort of seemed to me that when life opens up and isn't the way we know it, conditioning wants to make that about being wrong, rather than just, wow, this isn't the life I know.
Mm-hmm. So looking at those places of newness and how that's a place for conditioning to come in and make a story or point, say that there's something wrong with you about that.
Yeah.
Instead of just, this is a world that you haven't experienced before.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
One of the things that's so neat about Sangha is how often there seems to be sort of a theme. So there seems to be an energy theme. So I don't have external kids, but I have internal kids. And so I was looking at something, I've been looking at this huge energy that's up. And I have this interesting experience, I'm relating to what was said in initial sharing. And so I, part of what triggered, it feels like the awareness of the energy being up, was I actually was watching a movie. And there was a character in the movie that just impacted me hugely. And I couldn't figure out why. And I can even feel their tears down here. And so it came to one time, at one point I looked at her and I thought, she's who I used to be. Mm-hmm. Do you want to reflect that much?
So I'm looking at energy and one of the things that you've noticed recently occurred while watching a movie, and you were impacted by a character and you couldn't figure out why. And as you were watching, you saw this character, you realized that she reminded you of who you used to be.
Yeah, so I've said in here before that, you know, for most of my adult life I've identified on the Enneagram as a 5. Mm-hmm. But then I remember that when I was 5 I was an 8. Mm-hmm. And I realized that this person, to me, I was projecting that she's like my 8. Mm-hmm. And I love my 8. And so what conditioning is wanting to do with that is create a sense of loss and regret. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that was lost, is irretrievable, could have been so, you know, so good, has never been expressed, which is all not true. But if I get into the story, it feels true. And so it feels like, in a sense, my version of what was referred to earlier as shame, if I go with the story, is regret, a sense of loss.
That's a good version of that, going with the story and experiencing shame is going with the story and experiencing regret or loss, that the story is that's lost and it's something that could have been but wasn't and is irretrievable.
Right. And it's interesting because what the 8 represents to me is big energy. Mm-hmm. And and actually, I don't know, a while ago Sherry had this book with birth dates. Mm-hmm. And my particular birth date, the identifying characteristic, was the day of huge energy. So if conditioning catches me in the story, it can use my big energy in the story of how I don't have big energy.
Mm-hmm. So if conditioning gets a hold of the story, its story is it can use your big energy to feed the story that you don't have big energy.
That's right. That's right. And that's what it'll do. Mm-hmm. And so I've just been watching that dynamic of the opportunity is to drop the story and welcome everybody home. Mm-hmm. And to acknowledge that everybody's been there all along.
So the opportunity is to drop the story and welcome everybody home.
Yeah. I can just feel the emotion around that. You know? This morning when we were singing the daily recollection, it came to that part about, you know, beyond the gate of thought and desire. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh yeah, you know, thought and desire. I can just get trapped right at that spot. I can drop the thought and stop defining the desire and just experience the energy, how everything is possible, and how if I get caught in the story, the story is really all about what isn't possible, what never was, what never will be. And it's so sad because just on the other side of that story, everything's possible.
And so just on the other side of that story, everything's possible. The story is what isn't, what can never be. And on the other side of that, everything's possible.
Yeah. And the other thing you can do, you know, in addition to making me feel this regret because the eight is gone, is then to get me mad at the five for subduing the eight. Like there's some sort of warfare going on, you know? I mean, you can create this drama that I'm either in or I stand back from and just see as drama. Uh-huh. And that really is, boy, it's really light room, dark room.
Uh-huh. So it's really the light room, dark room experience of either being in that story and believing the drama or stepping out of it and seeing the drama.
Yeah.
Thank you. Alex.
I'm seeing something in this discussion so far, and part of what's arising for me in the initial how we started the whole conversation was that it seems to me like things start in innocence, and it just came to me while I was sitting here that I was like, because the story around it seems so familiar, you know, where I feel like I'm going along just fine. And like enjoying life and from that innocent kind of point of view. And I know I've told this story before, but it's my favorite, working at the movie theater story, I guess I must have gotten somewhere along the line I can't call a reputation, but like, if there's something that needed to be done, I was the person to do it, basically. You know, like, you know, if some kid had thrown up in the bathroom, would be like, there he is, let's get him. And I was just, I really just enjoyed doing whatever it was, you know, just going along, you know, sweeping popcorn, great, you know. That's what people go to the movie theater to do, is to throw it and drop it and spill it or whatever. And I would just go in there and do it. And, you know, I watched everybody else's just like, whatever, you know. So, you know, kind of like, puttering around the side and stuff like that. And the thing that I think flipped me at one point was the snowstorm. You know, with the piles of ice and stuff like that in the parking lot. And I didn't know it, but there was some sort of plan to see if I would go out there and do it.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, my boss asked me, go out there and go shovel all that snow. And I was just going along, getting suited up and got the snow shovel. I don't think we've ever used them, really. And then just found out that it was all a ploy or whatever like that to see if I would do it and then just have a laugh at the fact that I actually would go and do it.
So what was triggered was a story that you referred to before about when you were younger working at a movie theater and you were talking about just going along in a real innocent place and just participating like in an innocent place and that there was part of you there who just enjoyed doing whatever was the next thing to do, and then you were asked to go out and shovel all the snow and not knowing that it was a ploy to see if you would do it.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Mm-hmm. And just to have everybody there and just kind of pointing and laughing. And mm-hmm. I don't know where, I mean, it seems like the connection that was made in that was like, I need to be somehow different.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what happened from there, but I've watched there's just like this story that can come in as a result of, feels like that was a real turning point. You know, it was like, people are out to get you. You know, it's intentional when, you know, someone, you come to make a fun of you, and, you know, like, people are, like, cruel, basically. Mm-hmm. And it means something about me, like I'm gullible, and you know, like that I should feel ashamed of the fact that, you know, I just say yes. And so, you know, a huge thing that came up at that point was a big no, you know, and I watched how stuff stopped becoming, you know, fun. It's interesting how that plays out now, too. You know, I watched, because recently something, I'd gotten really interested in something that started from complete innocence, and I feel like really, like, from a good place, you know, like a helpful insight about where I was in life and what could be beneficial. And I watched how the whole thing just got turned over because of the story, like how it could be made into something. It didn't just become a practice. It became my practice. Mm-hmm. It became all about something that I was doing, and it had to look a particular way. And everybody else was messing around with it and not allowing it. It was clear that it was turning it into a story.
So it became clear that it was turning it into a story. And so looking back at that time in your life where that big yes turned into
a big no.
And the idea that people were cruel or out to get you, and so that innocent enthusiasm that you had, there was a big no to that.
That's funny. It was interesting because as you were saying that, I realized that it wasn't me working together with everybody in the movie theater. It was somehow my work. You know, like, this is my job. This is what I need to do. And I watched how that kind of artificial barriers around things started to happen. Like, it was more important about what it is that I was doing than what anybody else. I feel like it was like, you know, the separation, you know, it was like somehow what I was doing was suddenly more important, and I got lost in what I was doing rather than what was going on.
So you got lost in what you were doing and became very separate. There was a barrier put up between you and your work and what you were doing.
It's just so interesting. It even happens in practice, too. It's like I get focused on my practice, what it is that I'm doing, what's going on for me, and I lose sight of practice. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going on for everybody? Where are we? Mm-hmm. What are we doing as a self? It's amazing how that kind of like, it's interesting because, you know, in practice, we're asked to turn inward and look. Mm-hmm. But it's like questioning, well, who's turning in and looking, and what kind of assessment is being made about what's going on, and who's driving the show, you know, who's driving the ship or whatever like that, you know. So that's all just very interesting.
So looking at that in practice too, and we're asked to look inward, but you're looking at, well, who's doing the turning inward and looking, and what kind of barriers are being created by that?
Mm-hmm. I almost get this image of like keeping the doors open. You know, just what at all costs, because what they want to do is close back in on the story and, you know, keep me safe with it. And so just keep blowing it open, like, how does this fit into the big scheme? You know, how does this all fit in? How does this, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. So look at what's going on and keeping those doors open, because it wants to close those doors. Keep you isolated in the story. Mm-hmm. So just keep
moving
the story.
It looks like this kind of action. Just stay open. Thank you.
Cameron.
Two tracks that we've been on this morning have been tracks that I've been looking into recently. And the first one is the conversation about shame. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a time, I don't remember, at some point where it seemed like there was just a big lot of talk about shame. It was really the end thing to be exploring and stuff. And
I never did really relate to it or think it was an issue of mine. Mm-hmm. I think because I defined it in my mind as a, something that you were sorry or something about what you did. Mm-hmm. You know, you did something that you felt really icky about and you didn't want people to know about, that somehow it was about doing something.
So you've been looking at shame, and that has been something that you have, you in the past have not really related to us as something that you identify with for yourself, and you're seeing that you view shame as being icky about something that you had done, that there's some sort of action that was done that then you feel bad about, and it sounds like you're seeing it in a different way.
Yeah, and just that the topic of shame has come into my life, and it seems like I see it differently now. I see it is an issue, not only for me, but as I see what it seems like it is, it's an issue for everyone, because we're I was just reflecting back and wondering how come I never saw that as an issue for me, and I think that's why. So you know, it started my interest in this sort of started, you know, these TED Talks. You know, people send emails about the different TED Talks, people that are really interesting give these short little talks on the internet, and I saw one by this woman who, she's a sociologist, but she's a qualitative sociologist, so she's not a fact and number cruncher, she talks to people about things and qualitatively gets information, which I didn't even know that was a kind of a researcher we could be. I wish I had known that, because that just would be really interesting to get paid to do that. But it's too late. You know, probably. To get paid for it anyway. But what she started her interest was in connection. She wanted to know about connection. How do people feel connected? And what she found, I got interested after the TED Talk, and I've gone into it a bit, because that's an interest of mine too. What she found was that people just divided into two camps. And people who felt connected and people who did not feel connected. It's just, she said it was just amazing. They're just like, you know. So then she wanted to know, and I would have been right there with her on that trail, she wanted to know what made those people who feel connected, kind of naturally connected, what was it about them? And she did, you know, this is like years of research, and what she came down to was that people who felt connected felt they deserved love and connection. That's the only difference. Mm.
So you've been interested in a sociologist study on connection, and that they're are two camps of people, those who feel connected and those who don't, and that the main difference between them is that the people who feel connected, that they deserve to be connected or to experience love and connection.
Uh-huh. And the other camp, to use our language, which she didn't use, but the other camp, the way they were described, they did not feel worthy of love and connection. They basically were in the self-hate camp. Mm-hmm. And that what she saw was the barrier between the two camps was shame. Mm-hmm. That the people who experience self-hate are ashamed of themselves because they do not feel worthy. And so they feel, if I'm ashamed of myself, then I feel like I need to hide who I really am. And so how can I be connected with people, with life, with everything, if I feel like I have to hide behind this shield, because if I really expose who I am, then I won't be acceptable.
Mm-hmm. So those in that camp that don't feel connected, that are the, that when it comes down to it, is feeling shamed and not worthy of love and connection, mm-hmm. and that the that need of having to hide who
is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said I think it's a universal thing, Shane, because all of us that are conditioned, you know, until we learn that the conditioning isn't us, learn to believe that we are not enough. And so that would seem to indicate that, we kind of go around with that burden of shame. And I just found that really fascinating, that whole thing. And then the conversation this morning about at 12 years old, you know, that whole time frame seemed to hit at least three people so far. And I realized, boom, bingo, that hits me too. Because that's the time when you leave elementary school and you go into junior high school. And as a female, that means a lot about how you, what you do, how you look, how you dress, all of that. Talk about going into another world. Whoa, you know, as a young girl, I was just so, you know, I never thought of it as energy, but I was extreme outdoors, climbing trees, jumping pogo sticks, playing ball, throwing the ball further than the boys, all of that. And everybody would pick me to be on their team and all that. I loved it. And then suddenly, you can't be that way anymore. You can't even wear the clothes that would allow you to be that way if you wanted to. You know, the shoes and the skirts and the nylons and the whole lot. And you know, you gotta tease up your hair and put hairspray on. So, yeah, and so that brought in, as I thought of that, that also brought in the shame element to it, because once I was supposed to be that way and didn't feel like I could be that way, not only couldn't I didn't even want to.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even want to. And so then that added to the shame because I wasn't progressing into the right la-da-da.
Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of relating that shame to that transition period of being 12 years old and leaving elementary school and entering junior high, and what that means for the way that it's acceptable to dress and how it's entering a whole new world and one in which it's something you didn't even want to be the ways that were the acceptable ways to be, and yet that was the message you were receiving,
mm-hmm.
is that it was no longer okay to be this big energy sport, enjoying sports and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing that you had been free to express up until that point.
Yeah. So it just, you know, it's really interesting how all of these kind of different things are kind of coalescing in this conversation today and helping to see how it all fits together. And it's just like what was said earlier, it's so interesting how often that happens in our groups where
mm-hmm.
somebody starts something off and then a lot of threads come together and a lot of people in the room connect up to different threads and not pieces, maybe it is pieces of the spider web too, the threads. Yeah.
It's the same old as threads connecting to the
mm-hmm.
conversation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Justin.
I found that to be very interesting and helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mostly want to talk just to kind of help it land what I was seeing as Carolyn was talking. I also don't normally relate to that word.
Mm-hmm.
But according to how it was just talked about, then I mean, that's very much part of my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at, as Kim was talking, how that feeling of unworthiness and not deserving, I think she said love and connection, feels like the thing that's in the middle of all of the karmic things that I struggle with.
So in the middle of all the karmic things you struggle with is that not feeling worthy of love and connection and stuff.
Yeah, I think there's even a step under that, which is, you know, we talk about it in the there's nothing wrong with your work, that, you know, there is something wrong with me. There's like this fundamental, and it really is sort of a fundamental, not base layer belief that everything is piled on top of.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing that's kind of holding it there, and I can just feel it in myself. You know, as Cameron was talking, I can feel that, just this, there's a resistance to going to a place of like love and connection, even though I would say I've always wanted that. Mm-hmm. But there's a resistance to it because, you know, I don't, in the karmically, you know, I don't deserve it. I can't go there.
Even though you've always wanted that, there's a resistance to love and connection.
Mm-hmm.
And that underneath all that, there's this fundamental belief like there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I'm not sure exactly where I am right now as I'm looking at it, but I mean, I have, since I've come here, obviously, have learned a great deal about how to provide it for myself,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, you know, the greatest thing that could ever happen to a person, really. And it feels, that also feels fundamental to my life in another way. That's the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the recording and listening practice that we're doing, that's a big piece of it, and the mentor stuff we've been talking about a lot lately. But still, it remains. And particularly, and lately, there's one in particular, but there's others too, but one in particular karmic habit of that keeps getting pointed out to me of how I do things. And, I mean, it's been getting pointed out to me for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's it just keeps on, it just doesn't go away. And it keeps on following me, and I was looking at, why is that? You know, and I think this might be it. I don't deserve to have what I would have if I let go of it on some level.
So there's been a karmic tendency that's been pointed out to you and has been following you around for a long time. And you think that the root of that is that fundamental belief of the unworthiness of that love and connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it all just comes together in my mind as I say that. I can see exactly how, you know, like what's required for me to go beyond that karmic behavior is to align myself with, you know, say life, but in even more tangible, you know, more concrete than that, align myself with the guidance that's being offered. Or it's not even that really, actually, because it's align myself with a willingness to seek guidance and to be in relationship with guidance. Like along those lines, but of course, to do that, I would feel connected. I would be connected,
mm-hmm.
and so it just makes perfect sense of how, even though I mean this has been going on forever. I mean, I could tell you everything about it, probably. there might be actually probably things I don't know about it, but I could say a lot of things about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the behavior continues,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's why. I think there's just I don't deserve to have what would be there. I let that go.
So you can say a lot about it, there's a lot you can see about it, but if the behavior continues and you think that it's what it comes down to is that fundamental belief that the unworthiness of having that love of connection that would actually be there if you were to let that go.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually really helpful actually because I've been looking to see, you know, how can I get past this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what how can I approach this in a way that's different than I've approached it before that will lead to a different result. You know, we've been talking a lot about there's no change of consciousness without change of behavior, and so mm-hmm. I've been focused, okay, I need to change the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's true, but I think to do that, I need to change the belief system
mm-hmm.
that's there. Oh, and I would say that I've done that, and I don't feel like I've done that over and over and over and over and over again. Let that go, and let that go, and let that go, and let that go. But it remains. There's still a piece of it there. Maybe always will be. You know, maybe that's the thing that will drive me through practice for the rest of my life, is that thing there that just gets deeper and deeper and deeper, that kind of belief. I don't know. But it's, I think it's still there.
So you've been looking at changing the behavior, but you think that maybe that belief needs to change and that you have been letting go of that belief over and over and over, and yet it's still there, and that it may continue to be there and continue to be the thing that drives your practice deeper and deeper as you continue to let that go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can look and see the same thing looking at it from the opposite side, because the behavior creates the opposite of what I really want. You know, creates disconnection and isolation. And even though it doesn't feel like it at the time, it actually feels good, sort of, when it's happening. Mm-hmm. But, just continually, actually I could say that, I just flash through, this particular behavior is like, you know, work and just all that content related, but I mean, I could say that same thing about all the karmic behaviors. Mm-hmm. They all produce isolation and the opposite of what I'm really looking for.
All of those karmic behaviors produce isolation and the opposite of what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. One more thing, a little bit about it, then I'll stop. But there's this thing going on where I am eliminating, I'm attempting anyway, to actively eliminate time for conditioning from my life. Mm-hmm. And so whenever there's time, I'm filling it up with something that makes a contribution to something. Mm-hmm. So it might just be a contribution to my personal life by cleaning the hermitage or something, but mm-hmm. or it might be, you know, the work projects I'm doing, you know, outside of schedule. I worked all morning on something this morning. And it's funny because I feel like intuitively I've been sensing that without really being able to articulate that to myself. Mm-hmm. You know, because those things are connection producing mm-hmm. activities. Even if it's just for me, it's a connection producing activity. Mm-hmm. You know, cleaning the hermitage connects me with mm-hmm. me mm-hmm. and my hermitage. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, just as an aside, I love my hermitage. Because I've been putting all this work into it. Mm-hmm. And I've done this and I've done that. And I created this last weekend. I made this whole thing that, you know, put my shoes on and this thing. And I walk in there and I love you. But that's what it is. It's just a connection to something larger than me. It's really funny. And then other things I'm doing have the conditioning says have no personal benefit at all and so are completely useless. But maybe or maybe not, I'll have some benefit at some point to somebody else. But those do the same thing. They connect me. Anyway, it's funny how all that just kind of came together.
So you're looking at not leaving time for conditioning and filling that time with things that contribute to something, and it could be contributing to your connection with yourself and your heritage, and that those activities give you that sense of connection.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Structuring my life, not only room for conditioning. Mm-hmm. That's great. And I've been having that experience of loving my hermitage lately too. You know, just over time, just doing little things to like take care of it. Mm-hmm. And just, I think I come throwing in the other day, I'm like, God, it's, you know, it's pretty. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's just feeling, I guess just sensing that expression of love, mm-hmm. you know, that someone taking care of this being mm-hmm. by making that a really pretty, mm-hmm. pretty place. And the talk about shame this morning, that was great. And life in its infinite wisdom has been giving me some opportunities to explore some areas of self-hate mm-hmm. for me that I haven't been able to really see. And some of that's around, a big amount of it is around having what conditioning calls special movies, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like that I might have to do things in a little bit different way than other people, or ask for special accommodations. Mm-hmm. And, that's a big one.
That's a really big one that life is presenting you, the opportunity to look at the self-hate that's there around that. Right?
Yeah.
And looking at the need to ask for special accommodations or to do something in a different way.
Yeah, and I've just seen, I think it was talked about in a group a few days ago, about, you know, I'm not a person who, mm-hmm. you know, all the beliefs around that, you know, I'm not one of those people, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a person that just gets up and goes and, you know, not be a problem, mm-hmm. you know, and just seeing how that kind of attitude is probably the biggest special need of all.
The biggest special need of all.
Yeah.
To have that belief that you're not the kind of person who you get up and go.
Right. God, I'm not one of those people. You know. I'm not one of those people that can't eat this and that, you know, that I have to go, you know, get support here and that, you know. And just seeing that, it's just a great opportunity for humility.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great opportunity to embrace being human. Always, in that conditioned reality, being a human is being inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
Not accepting one's mortality, one's, let's see where it was. I was going somewhere with that. But I was just looking at what was Shah talked about in the group about on the radio show, that place of God acceptance and accepting this as if it was never going to change.
Mm-hmm. That place of acceptance as if it were never going to change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just embracing that in love and, because I still see this tendency, well, if I do this and this and this, then things are going to be like they used to be,
mm-hmm.
And what if they never are like they used to be? And being able to accept that and really in accepting, it seems like all the little deaths that, occur.
Mm-hmm.
And to just embrace that and let that go, let that go, let that go, let that go. Let that go.
So in acceptance of all those little deaths, and letting them go and letting them go. And really practicing with humility and with being a human.
And seeing that the opportunity there is to really to access that place that
mm-hmm.
doesn't die.
Mm-hmm. And the opportunity is to access that place that doesn't die.
That real authentic self, that mm-hmm. real, that place of love and connection,
mm-hmm.
that place of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And the place that has been just the call, to go to that place. And it seems like all of this just does help to bring it back to knowing that,
mm-hmm.
to looking there,
mm-hmm.
look here, look there, look to that place.
Yeah. Look into that place, that little authentic place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With the love and the connection and the care of that. Sure. With a few more words.
Well, I was just in the last couple of sharings, I was just seeing that, and I know this is what we've talked about in things like there's nothing wrong with you, but there's really kind of two levels of inability to connect in a way, because there is that hidden, there's something wrong with me that, for me it's like I can think of, so I come into the world, I'm perfect, I'm innocent, and then something happens where all of a sudden I believe the shame and that there's something wrong with me. And then the whole construct of an identity gets built over that to make sure that that's never seen.
Mm-hmm.
So both of those, there's that shame that's hidden, and then there's the identity that's public, but so carefully constructed that, I don't want to run into anything that's going to mess that up. And life runs into it, and practice runs into it, and I've noticed getting older runs into it. I cannot no longer maintain that this is who I am and how I am.
So you can't maintain any longer that this is who you are, this identity that is carefully constructed to cover up that shame, and life runs up against it, practice runs up against it.
Yeah, I just related to the last thing that was being talked about is, you know, when all of a sudden, you know, I'm not a person of needs. I know I used to say when I was growing up, I'd rather do it myself. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, I'm a person who can eat anything and lots of it, and to all of a sudden, no, you can't eat that. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I can. Well, it doesn't look like it. I mean, you know, it's just like somebody, you know, to try and maintain that picture of who this person is, it gets harder and harder all the time. And, you know, then I think that's so threatening then to then it reveals what that identity was meant not to let anyone see.
Mm-hmm. It's harder and harder to maintain that identity and harder to hide that, what that identity was created to.
Yeah, which actually, you know, and in hiding that supposedly shameful part, which is really more of a wounded part, you know, it just denies us access to our heart, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and the identity we constructed to make sure nobody saw what was wrong with us is the identity that makes sure nobody sees how wonderful we are.
The identity that's constructed to make sure no one sees what's wrong with us is also hiding people, or not allowing people to see how wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And us too, and yes, keeps us from seeing that too.
Ourselves from seeing that.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess in a way it's, well, not in a way, it's an opportunity to be grateful to all those things that poke holes in the identity. You know. Because we probably wouldn't do it voluntarily.
So it's the opportunity to be grateful for everything that puts holes in that identity.
Thank you.
That's our time.